Welcome to ESAB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Frank Lavin. Frank is a former Undersecretary for International Trade in the US Department of Commerce, and he's been working as a political director in the White House and in senior positions at the US State Department, including a stint as the US Ambassador to Singapore. Frank now regularly writes about trade and foreign policy, and he's also the founder of Export Now, a successful e-commerce platform in China. Frank has recently published a paper with ESAB called Learning to Love Trade Again, a paper that outlines a couple of initiatives that countries can take in order to revive the engine of trade liberalization. This is also what we're going to talk to him about today. This is based on an event that we did on June 25th. So here I give you Frank Lavin. Frank, well, very welcome to you. It's great to have you joining one of our Zoom seminars.
Thank you, Frederick. Glad to be here. I'm calling in from Singapore, where I'm in lockdown. I'm normally working out of Shanghai, but I'm sort of based in Singapore, where we're working through all the coronavirus restrictions. But it's great to reconnect with you, and thank you for hosting us today.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's our pleasure entirely, and thanks also for doing a really, really good paper for us. Before we start, let me just say a few words about you, if you don't mind. You live in Singapore, you work in Shanghai, but you are probably most famous for having spent a good time of your professional life in American politics. Being Undersecretary for International Trade at the US Department of Commerce, working in the White House during Reagan, and had sort of senior positions in the US State Department for quite a while. I mean, you're not exactly a novice to Singapore, since you were an ambassador there for a while as well. But now you, apart from running your own company, a very successful e-commerce platform in China, you also write a lot about trade, foreign policy, US politics, for instance. And you, I think you had a really good piece in foreign policy last week about the problems with building and keeping friendships in foreign policy,
right.
A piece which I recommend to each and everyone. Anyway, we're now going to start on trade, and I wonder if you could begin by sort of painting us a picture of where do we stand right now in trade policy, you know, the development up to the pandemic,
right.
Perhaps something right. During pandemic, and what you see coming after the pandemic, and perhaps a bit more pointedly, why is it that we need to learn to love trade again? Aren't we already in love?
Yeah, thanks, Frederick. Thank you for your kind words. Thank you again for hosting today. It's a great question because the paradox of the moment is I think we can see pretty clearly the success of trade, that the world economy has never been more prosperous, that the more countries engage in trade, the more prosperous they are. That it's added all sorts of efficiencies to national level economies by allowing them to connect and empowered people and transformed lives. So at that moment, though, the political support for trade has faded considerably. And it's a surprise for people who look to Geneva for leadership, because for 70 or 80 years through various GATT rounds and WTO rounds, there was a global liberalization process that always had elements of friction and always had, you know, sort of a political dimension to it, but was very successful in moving the world toward greater trade potential. And that was sort of a history of global trade from the inception of GATT in 1947 all the way until recent times when the Uruguay round stalled. Now we're at a moment where there seems to be almost a complete absence of support for trade in all political leading economies. People will rhetorically say, yes, I'm for trade, I want more trade, but there's nobody putting political capital or leadership into a new WTO round or into trade initiatives. And the US, I think, in some ways is more colorful, but it's not radically different. That the US, when Trump ran for office, he said he's pulling out of the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations. And there's been no real trade progress. The one initiative that's been launched in the U.S. in the last 3 years is U.S.-Kenya free trade agreement. So it's a very minimalist approach. So in this moment, we decided to take a look at, well, what if the political support for trade has significantly faded, what are some reasonable steps that can be taken that don't require unusual leadership where we could build a consensus? And these might serve as a guidepost for new WTO leadership that's coming in this summer, where they should be able to get some kind of support for these initiatives and would help trade move ahead.
Yeah. I mean, do you belong to the camp now? I mean, and I see sort of a lot of stories now being written, which is that globalization is dying, that, you know, perhaps because of the pandemic, or perhaps it was dying already before the pandemic started, but that we are irreversibly sort of in a political trend now, sort of where, you know, that whole underlying post-war premise of trying gradually to reduce the economic significance of trade barriers, that's basically gone away. We're now sort of in a period when most parts of the world will find one way or the other to try to raise barriers against each other.
No, I don't think that is the case, but I think what is unusual about our moment is that the anti-globalization voices are the loudest they've been in recent years, and in some places they're leading governments. So I think globalization will continue. I think international connectivity will continue. And if anything, the digital dimension of the economy is so strong and will continue so much stronger that it, you know, you almost don't need to start removing more formal barriers for economic activity to continue to be cross-border. And if you look at particular matters that were in very, very early days of e-education and e-health, heavily lend themselves to digital initiatives, very early days of those of them. But I think if we take a look 5 years from now or 10 years from now, we could see a significant amount of educational consumption being cross-border and a significant amount of health services, health monitoring, prescriptions, so forth, being cross-border as well.
Yeah. And what about Trump? I mean, you can at least make the argument that he came in and provided sort of a pretty strong reorientation of U.S. trade policy and sort of the thinking about international economic policy more generally. So, you know, assuming that, he's not going to be there forever. He may go after this sort of the election, the autumn, he may stay for another 4 years. But even if he go after this election, there's a sort of Joe Biden presidency coming in. Do you think, is that going to change much? Is America going to sort of return to message of economic rationalism, or are we now sort of in a period where sort of Trump's break with the past of American outward orientation is, if not permanent, so at least it's what we're going to live with for the foreseeable right. future?
I would say that's an open question. It was quite striking how Trump, you know, I guess this is a tribute to him and his forcefulness and his political skills, but he almost single-handedly was able to sort of shatter this consensus. No U.S. president had ever been denied a trade initiative by U.S. Congress in modern history in the last 80 years. So even though there was always an undercurrent of opposition and undercurrent of protectionism, the U.S. Congress always was willing to grant the president, Republican or Democrat, grant the president the leeway to do what he needed to do on trade. And so the U.S. moved significantly ahead on trade liberalization over 80 years. Trump is the first president in the modern era, first, I guess, since Herbert Hoover, to pull the plug and say trade is actually harmful, it's bad news, and that had always been sort of a minority view. So I think you're right. It shifts the debate. It shifts that Overton window where now it's more politically acceptable to talk about this. That's the word of warning that you alluded to. But I'd say, interestingly, there's almost been a course correction because in public opinion, the Gallup polls show us that in the general public, trade has never been more popular. So point one is trade retains general popularity. Point two, I would say, geopolitics threatens to return, meaning part of the argument for U.S. trade posture historically was Cold War dynamics. And the U.S. Foreign policy leadership believed it needed trade relations to underpin its geopolitical leadership. And you say, all right, there's a certain logic to that, but that also, there's a risk in that statement as well, because that tells you as the Cold War requirements fade, then support for trade fades as well. So DR, when we looked at U.S. put together a free trade agreement with Central American countries called DR-CAFTA. But the argumentation for that was heavily Cold War, civil society, democracy, pushing back against Cuba, that we need to do what we can to buttress the economies of these small, fragile Central American countries and not allow there to be Cuban inroads. And there's a reasonable point, and it got reasonable response on that. And you can't make that point anymore. So the departure of geopolitics, in some sense, diminished support for trade. I'm wondering if this rather unfortunate appearance of U.S.-Chinese friction will also provide some kind of political impetus to trade initiatives in the near term as well, and if it will allow the U.S. to get back into the TPP, back into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because if there's concern about China's reach in the region, if it's viewed as a matter of geopolitical competition, that is an argument for thinking through TPP again. And let me make a third point. We don't know what will happen in the U.S. elections. It could go either way. But one interesting point is the signature trade issue of the Obama administration was the TPP. This was Obama's baby. This was Biden's baby. And then Biden has legitimacy and stature in bringing this back if he so chooses, right? So there's several ifs in that sentence. I'm saying if Biden were to win, my guess is that this comes back onto the agenda next year.
All right. What about China? I mean, from your perch right now, I mean, living in Singapore, working in China, to what extent has Trump's confrontation with China, and perhaps more generally, the growing uncomfortability, not just in America, but in other parts as well, with China's role in the global economy, to what extent is that changing perceptions in Beijing about its role for future global trade governance? Are they opening up themselves? Are they closing themselves? Or perhaps are they doing both at the same time?
Look, China has liberalized quite significantly over 30 years, since 79, say over 40 years. There's been significant liberalization. And I would say in terms of percentage of the GDP that is state-directed as opposed to private-directed, it's probably not radically different than Europe or the United States, right? It's a significant private sector role. But having said that, I don't get the sense that there's a ongoing consensus for continued liberalization. There's always some initiative on deregulation or improvement, and so there's always something going on. But I think if you were to talk to Chinese leadership and to say, talk to me about the balance between state control and market economics, I think they'd say, we've got it. We have private sector involvement broadly. We're comfortable with it. But for the commanding heights of the economy, for the sensitive sectors, the natural monopolies, we really want those to be state run. So the steel industry, the railroads, telecommunications, banking, there's scope for competition in some respects, but these are going to be state-directed activities, and that's a proper state. So let the private sector run consumer goods, where I work, run restaurants, that's perfectly okay. But have the state still run the leadership institutions in society. And my guess is they're more or less comfortable with that approach. And the people in the Chinese system who really made the move toward liberalization, I'm thinking first, most famously, Deng Xiaoping, but then Zhu Rongji, who really said, listen, we've got to go down this journey. We have no choice but to liberalize because our economy is not a modern economy. You just don't have those voices in the system anymore. So if they're there, they're certainly being quiet about it.
And what type of geopolitical analysis do you see that other countries in Asia are making when it comes to global trade governance? I mean, you said previously that one of the inroads for America to return to sort of global trade politics may be on sort of geopolitics and sort of containing China. So opening up perhaps for American participation in the TPP again, thinking about other similar type of strategic initiatives. But what's the thinking in other parts of Asia? I mean, would they want more intimacy with America and American leadership? Would they rather sort of have China taking a stronger lead? Would they like to direct any new attention to the WTO system, or would they prefer to sort of deal regionally or bilaterally with any forms of new geopolitically motivated type of trade initiative?
Well, I'd offer a few comments. It's hard to speak, you know, in general terms about a region that's so multifaceted, but I think you'd say that for every country in East Asia, China is their number one trading partner. And if you ask them about the concern, it is a concern of concentration risk, that they're so dependent on China as a market or a manufacturing platform that there's a risk factor involved with that. And China has episodically brought that to light by telling the Australians, we can't import meat products from you anymore for safety reasons, or telling the Philippines, we can't import bananas from you. So they've episodically brought political issues into trading patterns, which causes unease in the region. So on the one hand, I think there is this general concern about concentration, that they don't want to be over-reliant on any one trading partner. On the other hand, there's also a view of sort of fatalism, or in the sense that most of the economies are small economies and cannot by themselves shape outcomes. So they can't induce greater appetite for the United States, but they can work on that sort of indirectly, but it really requires the U.S. to step up. The ASEAN country, the Southeast Asian nations, of course, have put together their own internal 10-country trading group, which is not a trading bloc, but it's a free trade area. And that's been, I think, a huge success, but that only gets you so far because it doesn't connect you to the broader world. So the next steps would be to bring the U.S. in through a Trans-Pacific Partnership or improve working relationship with the EU as well, right, both of which would be welcome. Right? So I think you'd say they want to move ahead on trade, but they're dependent very much on outside parties' appetite.
And what about Europe? I mean, when you look at Europe, or when you take sort of an Asian view of Europe or an American view of Europe, I mean, do you see a Europe which is willing to offer leadership for the global economy, or do you see a Europe which is perhaps becoming a little bit more inward oriented itself?
Well, you know, as an American, I should be careful about any comments about Europe, because U.S. has probably in recent years shown the least appetite for trade initiatives. And Europe's done initiatives with Japan, with Korea, you know, taken other kind of initiatives under its belt. So Europe is at least, I think, in forward motion in terms of trade initiatives. But that's not exactly the same as the question you posed, Frederick, which is to say that's a bit different than saying Europe feels comfortable providing global leadership. I don't see that. I don't see a global EU initiative at this point, but I see EU opportunistically looking for partners where liberalization would make sense. And I commend them for that. I think that's been a healthy development for them.
Before going a little bit more into the specific initiatives of the paper, let's talk a little bit about the World Trade Organization. Does the World Trade Organization also need to learn to love trade again?
Yeah, here's the rub, Frederick, and this is sort of the logic behind the paper. The WTO has been, I think, a very useful vehicle for providing architecture and a rules-based system and being a sort of an open platform which all parties can participate. So it's been a very useful institution, but it's not a leadership body. It's not the institution that you look to for the next idea in trade, and that frequently has come from the U.S. or from a leadership body working on the next WTO round or the next GATT round. Now we're at a moment where the U.S., I think, has pretty strongly signaled it's not going to be providing leadership to the WTO. Europe is probably somewhat absent from this discussion as well. I don't see any European leader stepping up on trade. So they're saying, well, what can the WTO do in this moment? In a way, it's a bit unfair to the WTO. The WTO has never had to rise to actually lead on a matter of trade. It's always been sort of a facilitator or an organizing mechanism. So one of the core themes that prompted this paper is whatever the new director general does in the WTO, the new DG cannot simply replay business as usual. The new DG cannot simply say, what I want to do over the next 5 years is do what's been done over the last 5 years. And I hope we get good news out of that. And if that's all that's done, then we won't have movement on trade. So we've got to look for alternative approaches that will spur the WTO and spur trade. And what kind of initiatives might there be that are sort of small enough that they won't be blocked or people won't find them objectionable, but big enough that they'll be actually consequential and the WTO and leadership can get behind these initiatives?
The first initiative that you outline in the paper is an architectural type of issue, right? I mean, it's not about trade reforms per se. It's more about where can we find leadership for the system right now? And you talk about the big three.
Right. The first point was, look, be careful about going to the WTO writ large, because the WTO is a consensus-based organization of 150-plus members, and just getting that consensus can be tedious, and it can take years, and it gives blocking power to anybody in that system. So I said, what you really need to do if you want the WTO to move is you need to set up some kind of leadership body, can be informal body, that is willing to undertake some of these reforms. And only when WTO members see other people moving are they also induced to move, right? So look at leading trading entities. And I throw out, this paper throws out, let's look at the US, Japan, and EU forming an informal consultative body, call it the Big Three, that would undertake some of these initiatives. And these three economies make up, you know, something like over half of world trade and half of global GDP. So it's not a bad building block if people want to set it up. And here's the important thing. You set it up on a plurilateral basis, meaning it's not exclusive. It's not a club in the sense of no members. It's an open platform so that any other WTO member can adhere to it and benefit from these initiatives. And of course, there's two big outliers here. One is China as the second largest economy in the world and huge trading nation. The other is by their own political system. The UK left the EU, so it normally would be involved in the EU framework, but now it's not. So you'd say you want a system that would allow China to participate, allow the UK to participate, allow anybody to participate if they can subscribe to these undertakings.
So one of the absentees in that group of the big three is China. So right. why isn't China sort of why aren't it seeing sort of China having sort of a natural role in an initiative like that?
It could. And I'd say this, if I were DG of the WTO, the first thing I do, I think, is go to Beijing and say, please tell me what your appetite is. Please tell me. We don't want China to block other people's appetite, but we always want to respect your appetite and your preferences. Because if China gets behind any of these initiatives, it'd be quite a potent show of support. So the first step we'd want to do is to take some kind of sounding about what are they willing to do, right? And you don't want to embarrass or criticize that. Every country's got their own political system, their own preferences, right? But I would definitely take a solicitous view. The reason, though, we start in this paper with EU, Japan, US, is all three of them have already publicly made statements to the effect and support of these initiatives, whereas China hasn't, right? And that might be more a reflection of Chinese domestic political circumstances. It doesn't necessarily mean China is opposed to these, but it's a bit of a question mark as to where China stands on these initiatives.
Is it also about sort of diplomatic housekeeping between sort of the big three, because all of them have substantial concerns with China and Chinese economic policies, right?
Well, I'll say this. I think there's probably more mutual trust and a higher degree of collaborative activity between those three than there is with China. I think you're right about that. It's going to be easier to get movement ahead. But I do think it's important to say this is a system that welcomes anybody's participation as long as they perform, as long as they're willing to act in accordance with the stated outline, we welcome. And by the way, all of these are not long-dated reforms. We're not saying over the next 5 years, you must do X, but you know, these can be undertaken in short order, because I said these aren't extravagantly complicated initiatives. So you could have the big three, you could have China say, we all agree with initiative number two, and we all agree to have this done within 6 months, right? So you'd have a reasonably short fuse and good scrutiny, you'd be able to monitor performance on this.
Yeah. Initiative number two, then, going more into the substance, is no harm, no foul. What do you mean by that, Frank?
Well, so one of the proposals that we put forward, no harm, no foul, is no country, no economy should impose tariffs on items that it doesn't manufacture. In this case, tariffs are just sort of a burden to trade, but they don't protect anybody. There's no domestic constituency that's harmed. So in our view, economy should be able to move very rapidly to liberalize in areas where there's no domestic constituency that might be injured by liberalization. And we cite in the United States, for example, the U.S. doesn't make television sets anymore, but still maintains a tariff on television sets. Well, why? That's for historical reasons, it seems. Well, why don't we just eliminate that? And you're giving a little bit of lift to global economy, a little bit of benefit to U.S. consumers, right? So that would be, but that's a good example of where China could readily step up and say, listen, we don't philosophically have a problem with this. It's not a huge step to make. It'll be tidying a few things up, and we're happy to liberalize in accordance with this proposal.
Yeah, and I suppose that politically may not be a difficult act either. I mean, considering for, you know, America, Europe, and Japan, their multilateral trade tariffs, I mean, they were basically set during the Uruguay round, and that's ended sort of over 25 years ago. And since then, the economy has moved on. So many of the tariffs, that, for instance, that America wanted to maintain or keep during the Uruguay round, America doesn't produce anything in those sectors anymore, like, for instance, television sets. And I think sort of you can also make the case that most countries here, I mean, the EU, Japan, to some extent America, but others as well, they've bilaterally taken away these tariffs already. So it may not be sort of an heroic political act to get this through political bodies as well in America, right?
Correct. I think any trading nation, China, any EU nation, the US, you could see a scenario where somebody from the trade ministry or the Commerce Department could give a talk on this issue and would not be met with hostility in their home market. So it's not a heroic step, but it is a nice step for liberalization in the market.
Yeah. All right. Initiative number three, de minimis strategy. What is that?
This says that any tariff rate below 2% should just be scrapped. That if your tariff rate is 1% or 1.5%, just eliminate it, because it costs you about as much to collect the tariff as the economic value of that tariff. So all it is sort of a nuisance fee, but it doesn't materially affect trade at all. It's just a slight burden, a slight tax on the system. So that is another step that, again, if you're looking at a 1% tariff and to do away with it, you should be able to do that without encountering a huge amount of criticism or ill will. So politically, that's a sellable initiative in my view.
All right. Initiative number four, mind the social costs. And you make here reference to Nairobi protocols, health products, green tech. What's the thinking behind this initiative?
Yeah, Nairobi protocol is a shorthand for a UNESCO initiative in place now. And there've been modifications, evolutions, but originally the UNESCO initiative said we're not going to put any tariff on education or cultural products. And the Nairobi protocol said that we won't put any tariffs on products for the disabled. So if there's some specific product, fair enough, all should be very good. We said, look, let's broaden that. This is a very important philosophical statement that some of these tariffs, some of these trade barriers have social costs beyond protectionism. And the social costs, I think, can pretty easily outweigh whatever nominal revenue benefit there is or protective benefit there might be. And we said, so let's at least expand all of the exclusions on tariffs to everything that is health related and medical related. We said, why not also apply to green tech, green energy as well? So why should we put tariffs on high-tech windmills or lithium battery assemblies? And why should we put tariffs on any kind of medical or pharmaceutical product? But let's let there be as much free trade as possible in these spaces, right? And you're just going to have better social benefits from it. And I particularly cite, because in the ongoing U.S.-China trade war, it was the United States that imposed tariffs on China, including medical products. And so something like $5 billion worth of U.S.-China trade in medical products is now encumbered by these tariffs that President Trump put on. So he specifically said, look, just do away with those, and you're going to help both China and the U.S. if you do that.
Lastly, but not leastly, harmonize down. The big three should commit that every tariff line between those three will be no worse than the next worst. So what's the thinking here?
Well, yeah. Look, a lot of times in these WTO discussions and negotiations, we're very aspirational, and we're trying to encourage trading partners to be as ambitious as possible in their liberalization. And sometimes it's just difficult. Sometimes there's just not the political support in these various markets for liberalization. So what we're trying to do here is scale back a little bit the aspiration. We're no longer saying, can you be the best in this segment? Can you match the best, meaning the lowest tariff rate? But we're simply saying, can you avoid being the worst? If you are the worst in this particular segment, meaning the highest tariff, can you at least harmonize your tariff down to the next worst? So you're no longer the outlier in any segment. So anybody who has the worst tariff in any segment agrees to reduce the tariff rate to be no worse than the next worst. So you're at least harmonizing a bit, and you're going to get some marginal improvements in tariffs.
The thinking behind many of these initiatives, and I think this is also the subtitle of the paper, which is it's time to think small again. Which is a provocative way, perhaps, of saying, you know, there is no opportunity to do any big things here. So we can sort of put that option aside. But how small are these ideas? I mean, to me, even if we're only dealing with tariffs, even if we're only sort of looking at ways to either harmonize down or to cut nuisance tariffs, we're still talking sort of about a lot of trade that takes place right now that are covered by these either high peak tariffs or by a lot of nuisance tariffs. So it's not insignificant economic gains that are going to arrive from this.
It's not insignificant. I think it all depends on your frame of reference, I think, Frederick. If you're talking about another WTO round or what the Uruguay round could have been, this is indeed much smaller than that. I would say less than 10% the economic impact of a WTO round. But even if you're at for conjecture's sake, to use a number, even if you're at 5% the value of a round, that's a huge number. That is quite a considerable number. It will have a material impact on all the participating nations. And then we know the second order effect of this kind of liberalization too, that you dampen inflation, you allow for a more efficient domestic economy because you're providing less expensive inputs to it, and at least you have started a collaborative process where people are starting to think about trade again and starting to think, what can they do? So we began this conversation today talking about this populist moment, this anti-trade moment. And I think one of the risks, if you will, of this kind of moment is that the trade debate is dominated by policy types who are hostile to liberalization. At least let's have the demonstration effect of liberalization, at least have a few modest steps ahead. So at least people can start thinking constructively about, all right, even if my country is not strongly in favor of liberalization, what inefficiencies can we fix and what anomalies can we fix? So at least we're in sort of the middle of the pack of global trade norms, and we're not burdening our consumers or our businesses with inefficiencies. So at least you're putting a positive push to the discussion.
I know you've been thinking about this, and it's in the paper, but it may still sort of be good just sort of to put the question out there. So what are you thinking sort of about the demonstration effect and perhaps the dynamic consequences of initiatives like these? And you could sort of potentially see, you know, two different alternatives. I mean, the first alternative is that you have the big three taking initiatives, and as a consequence of that, other countries will join. I mean, they will say, oh my God, now they are actually moving ahead. We need to do something as well. Or they're going to say, you know, this is not very significant. They're not doing anything big. It may be sort of that some of the things that they are taking away between themselves is also going to benefit us. So, I mean, I rather than joining, I'm going to be a free rider here.
Yeah, there will be some of that, no doubt. Here's the trade-off that the less enthusiastic countries have to think about. Right now, under the current WTO system, nothing is going on. So there's no particular cost to not leading on anything. You can maintain the status quo, and you're neither good nor bad. There's no initiative. All of a sudden, with the ideas we proposed in this paper, all of a sudden there's a few initiatives going on. And every country has to decide, do I collaborate? Do I try to shape the outcome? Do I partially collaborate? Do I oppose this? And all of a sudden, there's a potential cost for joining the process, but there's a potential cost for not joining. And the potential cost for not joining is follow-on activity, meaning if a collaborative pattern is established that allows the big three, maybe with China's participation, to undertake some of these initiatives, what's going to come next? Is there going to be a free trade agreement? Is there going to be sectoral-specific initiatives? What's going to come next? Because now there's a pattern of activity with these three or so economies, and you're not part of the conversation. So in that sense, you could see very strongly that it won't take much, to my view, it won't take much at all for Canada and Mexico to say, listen, we want to be part of this. Where our economies are so tied to North America and to Europe that we need to be a part of it. I think Australia will say the same thing. I think Korea says the same thing. So you're going to have a lot of major economies say, listen, we see what's going on here and we support these steps. These are incremental steps. They're in our comfort zone. We don't want to be absent from this conversation, but we'd rather be part of the conversation and start shaping it. So I think you're going to have a fair amount of participation in this process.
Do you think that participation also would come perhaps from less obvious countries? I mean, you mentioned now Canada, Mexico, and if America does something, they need to do something as well, because the potential consequences of not being part of an initiative that America is simply too big economically. I mean, the potential trade diversion effects can be too strong. What about other parts of the world? I mean, what about Latin America, Brazil?
I think you'll see it. I think life is a bell curve. So you're going to have a bell curve distribution of national appetites. And some of it has to do with the political philosophy, the leadership in these countries. But some of it has to do with, are you culturally comfortable with leading in international institutions? Or are you habitually more passive in international institutions? But if you're in that first group, I think you're going to warm to this. You know, I mean, the Uruguay round was launched in Uruguay because Uruguay historically said, we're very comfortable. We're a very small trading power, but we're quite comfortable playing an active role in international organizations. Singapore historically warms to the idea of playing an active role in international organizations. So you'll certainly see even smaller trading powers say, sign us up. We'd like to participate in this. Right. I think that reflects mainly the political DNA, the cultural DNA of the countries involved.
All right. Many thanks, Frank. Let me also now say to everyone that you are more than welcome to participate by either raising your hand, and you are going to be invited to put your questions or your comments directly, or you can send it through to me. I've already received a couple of questions and comments from people. So building on a one question that I've received here, which is about transatlantic relations, they haven't exactly been very good over the last couple of years, to say the least. And now we have trade conflicts around Boeing, Airbus. Mm. The other day, America opened up for sort of a new sort of consultation of putting new tariffs on European exports to America as a consequence of that first ruling from the sort of long saga with the dispute between Airbus and Boeing. We have a second ruling coming pretty soon, which is Europe is going to win that one, and it's most likely going to be allowed to introduce compensatory measures against exports from America to the EU. So we have sort of a tit-for-tat development.
Right. Well, there's also the digital issues too, right? There's
US
unhappiness. Indeed. I mean, so you've got sort of segment-specific issues that are festering there. Yeah, absolutely.
Indeed. So, I mean, how do you see these issues being played out?
Yeah.
And I think sort of the broader context here also, sort of in light of your paper, Frank, is basically that, well, you know, it's all and well that we're going to talk about taking away de minimis tariffs and harmonizing down peak tariffs and all that, but sort of, look, we are fighting over digital taxes, we're fighting over sort of Airbus, Boeing, and it, aren't all these issues going to pester this relation anyway?
They will, and in a way, listen, I really like these questions because I think it illuminates precisely the problem we're in. And to put it conceptually, the problem we're in is that the trade relationship is dominated exclusively by problems. There's nobody talking opportunities, potential, aspirations, moving ahead. We're only at a point where we're sort of litigating, you know, against injustice or perceived injustice or historical problems, right? And by the way, I don't speak to the specific problems. I might be very sympathetic to the American point of view. That's not, that those in themselves aren't necessarily harmful. What's harmful is if that's all you're talking about, to the detriment of the entire relationship, is just the problems and there's no positive agenda. And also, we have to say this takes place at a moment of, I would say, political deterioration as well. So you're really burdening what I think has historically been a very positive, mutually beneficial relationship by limiting the entire trade discussion only to I've got a problem with you and you've got a problem with me and I'm going to put sanctions and tariffs and you're going to respond and we're going to litigate, and the entire debate is defined negatively. And I think that's very unfortunate for a serious relationship. And if anything, now is the moment to say, listen, without speaking to a resolution of these, the aircraft issue or the digital issue, without speaking to resolution of the issues, can we at least get a positive set of discussions going? So at least we inject some good news in the picture as well. And at least remind both economies there's a lot at stake here, there's a lot of success, and let's look for ways, simultaneous with trying to fix the problems, let's look for ways to move ahead as well. So if you ask me, it's all the more reason for both Brussels and Washington to look at these specific ideas. And I think it would be a very powerful gesture if the U.S. and the EU said, before the end of the year, we're going to scrap all tariffs 2% and less. We're going to do this in the spirit of rationalism and in the spirit of friendship and the spirit of leadership. We're going to try to move our economies ahead on trade, right? That would be just a very nice message to put in the middle of this low-level fist fight going on aircraft and digital trade.
And more specifically related to this question, so absent that framework of some positive, constructive discussions and initiatives, you know, do you think it's possible to resolve the frictions that exist between America and Europe on you know, aircrafts or other issues?
Yeah, I do. My concern is twofold. My concern is there's not a lot of goodwill to begin with. So it's but look, when I was in the Commerce Department, we worked on some of the subsidized loans, the Hermes and other kind of the export import bank kind of mechanism. So we at least cap the loan rates of subsidies. So leadership in both economies realize that permanent subsidies are expensive and distortive and not fair, and they've got to find a way to unwind those, but they've got to do so in an orderly fashion because there are significant constituencies and industries that depend on it. And then you get into adjudicative process because some of this is a bit subjective. What's a subsidy? What's a normal market condition? But you can at least start going down a path toward market rationalization. It does require goodwill, and it does require a bit of patience. I'm not sure if we've got that at present in the leadership. And the second point I'd make is that the ethos of the current U.S. administration is one of grievances. And its view of trade is, the point of trade policy is not so much to move trade ahead, but is to redress grievances. People have been unfair to us, and we're going to stop that. We're going to fix it. So almost by definition, you have the absence of a positive agenda, and you have the entire negotiating apparatus just focusing on fixing these grievances. But also, if that's your worldview, I mean, it's that old saying, if to the child with a hammer, the world is a nail. If you're saying your job is to find out what Airbus is doing that is subsidized or not allowed or can be, is actionable, my guess is there's a fair amount there. So you can spend the rest of your life chewing into that, right? So I'd say it's in everybody's interest to say, don't define yourself exclusively on this set of issues, as important as they might be, but also get some kind of positive. So it's in Europe's interest as well as America's interest to say, just let's have an alternative conversation going on simultaneously to the Airbus issue.
Another question. So first, a point of clarification. The initiative that you were talking about is a plurilateral initiative outside the World Trade Organization. Follow on that, aren't this sort of going to be the final nail in the coffin for the WTO? I mean, aren't you sort of basically giving sort of a proposal here which is going to destroy multilateralism?
No, I think very much the opposite. I think this spurs it. I think the WTO is going to move when they see something going on. So, for example, the U.S. and Europe announced elimination of tariffs under 2%. Japan says, all right, we're game. China says, we can do this, we're game too. So right away, you're at 70% or so of global trade, global GDP, and then you have other trading partners, Canada, Mexico, outlined up too. Then I think you're actually in a very strong position to say, listen, let's just take this through the WTO process. We already have a huge critical mass of everybody's on board this, right? And the major trading powers have already started to implement this. So now you can make a virtue out of this. Now you can enshrine this in the WTO process and make it universal. But there's also a bit of a implied warning to WTO too, that even if you choose to block it, even if one of the non-participants wants to block it, doesn't want WTO, it's still going to go ahead. So it puts the spotlight on the slower moving countries to say, my friends, you have two choices. You can collaborate with these improvements in world trade, or you can use your role in the WTO to block it, but it's going to go ahead regardless. So this just puts a little bit of pressure on the slower moving countries to step up on these kind of issues.
So it's a glorified version of sort of the TPP, no?
Yeah, it is a glorified version. That is, we saw this with the Uruguay round. The Uruguay round was moving to completion. It always hits a soft spot. It always sort of slows down, and the U.S. moves ahead with NAFTA. But that was quite a signal to say, look, the U.S. is going to move ahead on trade. We'd love to do it in the WTO process. If some members of the WTO aren't comfortable with it, we also have the capacity to do it outside the WTO process. So let's just take it through to the finish line through the WTO, and that benefits more countries, right? So it did spur the WTO.
All right. We're going to take a direct question from the audience here. I'm going to invite Peter Kleen. Very welcome, Peter. I'm going to allow you to talk now.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here, and very, very important paper you put out, Frank Levin. I have two comments, I'm a bit skeptical about two basic premises on which your paper rests. The first one is the big three. And I remember the process in Uruguay round, where the EC and the United States and Japan sat in the GATT house, quarreling over the terms of reference. And nothing happened until the so-called Café au lait group took the lead and put together a terms of reference in the EFTA house. And that turned out to almost 90% become the terms of reference for the whole Uruguay round. So, and from a geopolitical point of view, US, Japan, EU, well, China must be there, as Frederick said, and India. So my recollection, my experience is that if something is cooked up among the big ones, if India is not on the bandwagon, so to say, nothing will happen. And your paper is a bit, you get the impression that the plurilateral way is a sort of panacea. I'm not buying that totally. Because several scholars have said the main explanation why so few new multilateral agreements have been agreed upon since 1995 is, according to my view, not the principle of consensus in the decision-making of the WTO, but rather the rather substantial differences of views between the big powers. So there you have the big differences. So, yeah, I mean, if US, EU, and Japan could come together and be, I think you maybe get also China and India on the board. But if there is still, that's the main hinder for coming together. So I think this plurilateral way, as Fredrik put it, it's a bit dangerous, and it's a nail in the coffin for the WTO, I'm afraid. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Very well spoken, Peter. And I find myself in general agreement with many of your points, not in complete agreement, as you might imagine. But you raise, I think, some very well-founded concerns. I would say that my plurilateral point, the paper's plurilateral point, has as much to do with game theory as with trade policy. Meaning, if you want the WTO to move, the least effective way of getting the WTO to move is to get a new DG to go to all the member states and say, please move. Please, let's try to be smarter, better, more creative. Let's move. Let's do something. That will be the least effective way. The most potent tool we have is to be able to say somebody else is already moving. If somebody else is already moving, now you need to think in a different way about should I move or not. Because right now, as we said, right now, not moving at all is cost-free, risk-free. And you say, I'm open to moving, but nobody's doing anything. Right? That's where the WTO is today. So until you start saying there is movement that is taking place, do you start to induce people to start thinking about should I move or not? So that's the main logic of doing something. I think your concern is well-founded, no doubt, meaning do the major economies have an appetite for this anyhow? How feasible is this? Is a very good point. And what we know in the US, in the EU, in Japan, in China, there is a significant gap between philosophical support for trade and political reality. What are you going to do for trade today? Right? We know every speech that the trade ministers make in all of these economies, they all support more trade. They support trade liberalization. They support the next round. They support it. So rhetorically, philosophically, all of these economies are committed to improving trade regime. But then when you put something in front of them and say, can you support this, you get different kinds of opinions. So it was in that in mind, we said, listen, we've got to come up with some ideas that are reasonably modest, that even a very slow moving trade minister can support. So let's put a few things on the table and see if we can get some kind of buy-in. I think the paper does a good job of that, but I think your concern is well stated, that no matter how modest the initiative is, you still could easily have somebody in Washington or somebody in Brussels say, I don't support this. It's too much for me, right? You also make another suggestion that we wrestled with, which is, look, why three or possibly four leading? Why not five, six? Why not India? Why not? Fair enough. At some point, you're going to have a trade-off. You've got to have a small enough group so that people can move. But of course, the bigger it is, the more inclusive it is, the more potent it is, right? So I do think plurilateral allows you to get the best of both worlds. And I also think I would tell people, use diplomacy, don't use publicity. That we're in this odd moment now where every single political issue, policy issue, tends to be fought out on Twitter. And I would say that won't get you anywhere. You know, if you want to get China buy-in, which I would welcome, if you want to get China buy-in with this, it's going to take a trip to Beijing. It's going to take a few trips to Beijing and a few discussions and maybe several months, but they might buy into all of this, or they might partially buy in, right? And as you point out, Japan could have ambivalence on some of this as well. But if you take a few months of soundings, you could end up with a decent package. And look, I'd be very practical about it. If India says, we've heard about this and we'd like to be involved, I'd say fantastic. Now, India has never shown an appetite for leadership on trade. It has never shown it. And Kamal Nath, I think, notoriously played sort of the leading obstructionist role of trade policy in the WTO system. So it would be welcome. Maybe, you know, we all grow, we all change. It's a different economy now than 10 years ago. So maybe they support trade. But I think you have to go into this open-minded and understand that every country has a different appetite, different political system, different preference. So have a system that allows for variable architecture and allows you to move ahead and capture victory where you can find it.
All right. Thank you very much, Frank. There are a few other questions from people that I'd like to put to you. And you know, does it really make sense to go for big three or big four or big five, even big 10? Why don't sort of look at mid-sized powers that are much more convinced about the benefits of doing trade liberalization, put them together in a group. So you'd have some in Asia, we would have Australia, New Zealand, Canada, you would have perhaps Chile, and a few other countries. Would you say that there is any sort of demonstration effect coming from an initiative that sort of wouldn't be from the big three, but be from sort of the countries that come sort of next on the ranking?
Well, look, you get economic value whoever moves on these initiatives, and I believe, you know, you look at elements of these initiatives, and they can readily be adopted unilaterally. And indeed, the UK, when it was in its looking at alternatives with its UK with its EU treaty, the UK EU treaty, if that wasn't going to fall out, there's going to be a break without a treaty. They were looking at scrapping all tariffs on light items below 2.5%. So they picked a more aggressive number than this paper put forward, but the logic is still there. So there's nothing stopping anybody from saying, we in our country, in New Zealand, we will not put any tariff on any medical device, medical technology, or pharmaceutical. For all I know, that's where New Zealand already is. But I'm saying there's value. These are crafted, so there's value in those kind of initiatives regardless of who subscribes to it. But the more economic weight you have behind it, the more it is likely to induce other people to also subscribe to it. If nothing else, take a country like Egypt. If nothing else, Egypt can say, why are we putting tariffs on pharmaceuticals when 70% of the world has already scrapped tariffs on pharmaceuticals, right? Now we risk being a bit of an outlier, a bit of a laggard. Why don't we just join with the consensus direction here, right? So it does, I think, provide more of an inducement than the smaller economy. But I would welcome any movement on these matters by small or mid-sized economies.
There's a comment here also basically suggesting, I think it's an interesting comment, suggesting that the use of plurilateral agreements have been, they have been used in the past. So during the Tokyo round, you had development of certain type of codes that were later incorporated into the WTO during the Uruguay round. So it's not sort of an unprecedented way to move forward. Final question, though. So this is for the big three, but what about United States and Europe? Should we basically write off the idea behind TTIP entirely? Is it just sort of a fanciful initiative that's not going to go anyway?
By the way, I personally think there would be enormous value in TTIP. I would like to see it go ahead. What I don't get the sense from the current U.S. administration is there's an appetite for liberalization. The one initiative underway is Kenya. The one discussion there's been has been a UK-US initiative, but I just don't get the sense that people are going to put their shoulder to the wheel. And look, we know that on manufacturing, it would not be that difficult. Manufacturing could move pretty readily. The tariffs aren't that high. There'd be some standards and regulatory issues that have to be dealt with, but the manufacturing tariffs are pretty easy. We know the real hard slog is going to be in agriculture, where there are significant constituencies and political groups. So that's going to be longer. But I'll tell you, there's also a solution. And the solution is what we've seen with other free trade agreements U.S. has done, which is you long date the agriculture. So you're giving people 10, 20 years to adjust. And you also be prepared to write a check, be prepared to pay people. You know, I worked on the U.S.-Korea free trade agreement. We saw these extraordinary numbers. I'm going to forget this now, but it was over 10 years ago. But the numbers we saw from that discussion was something extraordinary, that the average age of a farmer in Korea was something like 70 years old. And meaning that the next generation, the son or the daughter, did not want to spend their life on that Korean farm. They had already said, we're not leaving, and the father was stuck doing it. So the good news in that kind of situation was, you were able to come up with a mechanism to say, we can write checks to small holders and the less efficient farmers to move them out of agriculture, because there's just not the demand and the efficiency for that group anymore. So we could see that unfolding, especially if you put a 10 or 20 year timeline on it, then all of a sudden it becomes much more doable, right? So, but look, it requires leadership, because there's going to be a political dimension to this, there's going to be an economic dimension to it, but both Europe and the US would be much better off if we go down this path.
And really finally now, Frank, so do you see American trade politics changing after the November election in the event that we're going to have Joe Biden as the next president? Are we going to have new leadership from the White House, which is pro-trade and that wants to begin to rebuild things?
I think what you'd have with Biden, and I don't speak for the Biden campaign, so this is just conjecture on my part. But I think what you have is sort of regression to the mean, meaning U.S. is behaving more as it typically has over the previous 70 years, meaning Biden is more from the traditional internationalist school of U.S. leadership that looks at a requirement for U.S. to play an international role, but sees cost and benefit to it. But you have to then define what that role will be. But Biden very much believes in an alliance process and a collaborative process, and that's been a hallmark of his time in the Senate. So I think we're at least back to normal. And as I said, he's got one huge advantage, which is on the Asian side, not the European side. But I think he's got sort of an open door to reinvigorate or relaunch TPP. So I would say that's an easier prediction to make. What his overall appetite is a little harder to predict. I mean, the core problem, you will, or core challenge, you will, is that one of the anchors of support for the Democratic Party is organized labor, and organized labor is regretfully suspicious or hostile about trade initiatives. So he's going to have to come to terms with that phenomenon as well. But in general, I think I'd be more optimistic about Biden leading on trade than Trump.
All right. Thank you very much, Frank. This has been a very good hour. I think it's been sort of very enlightening, a good discussion. Thank you so much for taking the time. And indeed, thank you so much for writing the paper in the first place. It's a really great paper. And I can encourage all of you to access our website where you can download that paper, Learning to Love Trade Again, where Frank and Oscar Guinea outlines these initiatives in great detail and also provide sort of an overall analysis of where we stand. So thank you so much, Frank, and thanks to all that have participated here in Zoom or that have watched us in broadcasting. Thank you.
Thank you, Frederick. Thank you to those wonderful questions. It was great having this conversation. Special thanks to Oscar, who did a lot of work on the paper. A lot of the econometrics and the charts and graphs were all through Oscar's side of things, so it really made for a strong paper, and ESIPE just did a wonderful job. So thank you, everybody, for support during this process.
Thanks so much, Frank. Bye-bye.